And here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode number 42.
I guess two is the lucky number tonight.
Two is the lucky number. There's just you and me, what? Sarah and Adam. This is how we're going to do this.
Let's do it. Back and forth.
Yeah, this
crossfire.
Is a crossfire as far as Cinema Squabble is concerned. Thank you much for joining us, by the way. Cinema Squabble, you can find us at cinemasquabble.com. You can find us on Stitcher. You can find us on iTunes. You find us wherever you may cast your ears to listen to this podcast. And you've already found us. So way to go. Good on you.
You're so, so lucky.
Yeah.
Enjoy yourselves.
Seriously. So we've got a handful of films to talk about tonight that came out some last week, one this week. Yeah, so a little thin this week as far as films are actually concerned.
Four big releases.
Yeah.
Two of which screened, one of which screened on a weekend when none of us could see it.
Right.
And the other two not screened at all.
Yeah. So, you know, so it goes.
Interesting.
I mean, we're kind of in the dregs of the tail end of summer.
Well, it's, you know, Labor Day weekend and the weekend after Labor Day typically are a little slower,
yeah.
And then we accelerate again through the rest of September towards the end of the year.
Yeah, because we start moving towards Oscar at a
fevered
pace.
And we're going to talk about two of them tonight, but there are two Oscar potential movies that were released during the first 2 weeks of September, which is unusual.
I actually would say there may even be more than that going on, but let's get into it, shall we, right away.
Let's do it.
So Morgan came out a few weeks ago. I think this was actually 2 weeks ago.
This was also last Friday.
Yeah,
yes.
Oh, was it last Friday?
It was last Friday.
Okay. Yeah,
be forgiven for not remembering that, seeing that it's so memorable.
Most folks actually missed it. But
they did.
Here's the gist of Morgan. It's sort of a clandestine scientific corporation has this research facility in the middle of nowhere, and they've fabricated a humanoid named Morgan, who's actually Anya Taylor-Joy. And she's become part of this this experiment that is under interrogation by an investigation risk management consultant by the name of Lee Weathers, who's actually Kate Mara, sister to
Rooney Mara. Yes.
Which is kind of a way to go, Mara clan.
I know, right?
Like the whole family is
very
getting
talented.
In on this. But this tight-knit group of researchers and scientists at the facility, they may have a thing or two to kind of hold back or hold against. Who's who? What's what? That's all going on. And they've got something up their sleeves.
Why is Lee Weathers there?
And
that
just,
is the question that hovers over the movie.
Well, the other thing is who's going to walk away from this whole encounter? That's the other big question.
Exactly.
So this is actually a really peppered cast of quite talented actors. Jennifer Jason Leigh for about 30 seconds.
Sure.
We get Paul Giamatti for about 10, 15 minutes. And Toby Jones, Michelle Yeoh, I've already mentioned these two. Director Luke Scott, son of Ridley Scott.
Yes.
And so this is sort of his directorial debut as far as major feature-length films. And it certainly has the hallmarks of some compelling sci-fi to it. Sarah, you and I both kind of walked away from this and went, well, that was interesting. Let me think through on this one. Where's your thought process on this?
So thinking through on this one was probably the last thing I should have done.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more I thought about this movie, the more writer Seth W. Owens' script really, really started to annoy me.
Yeah.
It's a really dumb script.
What particularly annoyed you by it?
Well, I mean, the way these characters interact, how they communicate, and what they do is really blatantly stupid.
Mm.
But it's juxtaposed with some real directorial talent on the part of the younger Scott.
Yeah.
I mean, he sets the stage beautifully. He knows how to compose these scenes. He has learned a lot from his father. We'll put it there.
It's
a very icy, cold film, but it's purposefully that way.
Yeah.
I mean, because the emotions inside it are so heightened because all of these scientists know far more about what is going on and why than we, of course, do. We're supposed to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in this heightened form of almost paranoia right from the get-go. And, you know, I really think Scott, he does a great job of making the audience feel that.
Mm-hmm.
But the more you start thinking about what these characters are saying one to one another and what they are doing, the dumber it gets.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, the key moment is this scene between Paul Giamatti, who plays a psychologist, who has come in to speak with Morgan. And we know at this point that Morgan has done some pretty crazy, bizarre, weird, violent things. And yet the two of them are in a room together, alone, and they're having this conversation. And the acting in this scene is fantastic. Giamatti is great. Young Taylor Joy, who we just saw in The Witch as the main protagonist, the little girl who sort of uncovers all the mystery.
Yeah. The becoming witch.
Exactly.
Of The Witch.
Yeah. She is also wonderful in this scene, and they're both just the rat-a-tat-tat, the back and forth, the way they're reacting to one another, all of it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But then you start realizing what it is Giamatti is saying and what he is doing,
mm-hmm.
which is just so dumb. I can't even come up with a better word. I'm trying to come up with a better word than
no
dumb.
There is no psychologist that would ever do what Paul is doing.
And
I don't want his character doing.
Exactly, and I don't want to reveal what ends up happening.
Yeah.
But you just want to slap yourself in the forehead when it's all done because, of course, this is what's going to happen because of the way that you are acting.
Right.
And it's also the catalyst that then sends us down the rabbit hole of the last 30 minutes of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so the acting's great.
Mm-hmm.
I love the fact that this has one of the more powerhouse female-centric casts that we've seen in any movie this year. I love that it has nothing to do with how beautiful they are. It has to do with how intelligent they are.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is great and laudable and wonderful, but who cares? It's just dumb.
Yeah, and I have to agree with you on that. I found a lot of the twists and the turns of this script just really telegraphed and super predictable. And if you actually are familiar with Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, which is a strong influence to a lot of what we see going on here, there are a lot of nods to Dad going on in this film. And so this may be one to partner, I think, with Blade Runner. Go watch Blade Runner. And then when this comes out, maybe as a rental later, watch this as the follow-up to that. And I think you'll probably catch on to what's going on here perhaps a little quicker. But the rest of us, I think we all kind of sat through the theater and went, oh, yeah, we kind of guessed that might be what's happening here. And
so a little bit
of the fun's deflated.
What's really funny is, I mean, again, we were talking about how great the female mm-hmm. members of the cast are, but you did bring it up. Jennifer Jason Leigh is in this movie for maybe 5-10 minutes.
Tops. Yeah.
Tops. She has absolutely nothing to do except deliver one key line of dialogue
mm-hmm.
that if you are even remotely intelligent, it reveals the entire movie from that point forward. And I get where it's at, and I know why it's there,
mm-hmm.
but, I mean,
womp, womp.
So you could have used her so much better.
Where do you come in on this overall? Theater, rent, skip?
I went from a mild rent
mm-hmm.
to when I actually wrote the review,
yeah.
and now I'm a pretty solid skip.
Wow.
I just, even with the stuff that I like about it, and even with the stuff that I think is, you know, that we should celebrate about it.
Sure.
The movie's just lame.
Huh.
It just doesn't work.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm not going to go that strong. I'm still in the rent category on this. I think there's still enough redeeming value to it. And I think it makes, like I say, a good partner piece to Dad. And so go see one, then see the other, rent them both, enjoy it, make a weekend out of it, something like that.
I would say, but watch this one first, because Blade Runner is so much better.
Okay, strong point. Yes.
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
It's going to end up looking worse if you watch it after Blade Runner.
This is true. So,
okay.
Other one, our good friend Derek Cianfrance has a new film out, and this is actually at the Seattle International Film Festival. It's at SIFF Seattle here. What is the name of the theater?
It's the SIFF Cinema Uptown.
Yeah, the Uptown.
Yes. Over at the Uptown Theater.
I drove by the marquee today and said, yep, there it is.
There it is, right there.
Tell us a little bit about The Light Between Oceans.
The Light Between Oceans. Light Between the Oceans is based on the best-selling book by M.L. Stedman.
Uh-huh.
It's with the screenplay, as you just said, by director Cianfrance.
Yep.
It is the story of a World War I veteran
mm-hmm.
who comes to a small Australian seaside town to take care of their lighthouse. And he wants to do it all alone, by himself. Something happened during the war that just has closed him off from the rest of the world.
Could quite possibly be suffering from PTSD, just not identified as that in that era.
His name's Tom. He's played by Michael Fassbender. And, you know, being Michael Fassbender, he shows up on the island before having to go out to the lighthouse and immediately catches the eye of the most eligible bachelorette on the island, Isabel, played by the great Alicia Vikander.
Yes.
And what happens is, at first, because his island is separate from the little township
by like 100 miles,
something huge. It's a boat trip.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a significant boat trip. They correspond via letter,
mm-hmm.
and they fall in love,
mm-hmm.
and they get married. And she goes, and because they get married, she then can come to the island.
Yep.
When she gets to the island, they try to have children. She has 2 miscarriages.
Yeah. Heartbroken.
Things are horrible, and yet their love is allowing them to somehow persevere.
Mm-hmm.
But immediately after she has the second miscarriage, a little dinghy washes up on the island mm-hmm. from the town. And it contains...
Well, they don't know if it's from the town.
They don't know for sure, but we end up learning later on that it's from the town.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to throw that out there. It's not a big spoiler.
Yeah.
In the dinghy is the dead body of a man, a young man,
mm-hmm.
and the barely breathing, frigid, ice-cold body of a little baby girl.
Yep.
And instead of letting everybody in the town know what's happened, they decide to keep the little girl as their own.
Yep.
And that is basically the story. And what we do is we follow the next 4 years of the two of them raising the little girl,
mm-hmm.
Being great parents.
Yep.
But Tom is really wrecked with guilt by this,
yes.
especially after he learns that the little girl's mother is maybe still on the island.
Yes.
And she's played by Rachel Weisz.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the triangle that develops through the remainder of this film as will Tom do what he perceives as the right thing and basically give the daughter back.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very deep, passionate, hard-hitting romance on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
And it
also goes further, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
It's the question of will he give the daughter back, and will Vikander still love him either way?
Exactly.
Will that love persevere?
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, not only was he dealing with his own version of PTSD from the war, she, of course, is dealing with her own
mm-hmm.
Post-loss depression of the two miscarriages.
Mm-hmm.
And so she, this little girl is her own. This little girl becomes their daughter. Did they do the right thing? Of course they didn't. And mm-hmm. yet you still feel for them because they are such great parents.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really hard film on a lot of levels because you understand the dilemma that they're in, but at the same time, you don't want to say that you would make the same choice,
mm-hmm.
that you would just assume that you could essentially take this little girl.
Mm-hmm.
The acting is incredible across the board. It does dip into some melodramatic treacle, especially during the last half hour or so. It doesn't always maintain a tight enough focus on what's going on, and I'm not quite sure it earns its denouement set in 1950, and I don't want to, mm-hmm. but, you know, we fast forward a bunch of years, and stuff has obviously happened, and there's a sort of an epilogue,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure it earns that.
Yeah.
But this is the kind of movie, I mean, Cian France is really good at creating these complex emotional scenarios that you can't help but find yourself getting drawn more and more into. If you look at Blue Valentine, if you look at The Place Beyond the Pines, if you look mm-hmm. at this movie, he's really deft at doing that.
Yeah.
And he also makes movies that, even if certain elements inside of them turn you off, you find yourself wanting to go back and rewatch them anyways mm-hmm. and to see if your opinion sort of changes or morphs or evolves in the same ways that the characters do.
Yeah.
This is a movie that I could really foresee. Right now, I'm sort of torn in a lot of ways about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's things about it that I can't embrace, that I have trouble with. But I have this feeling that if I watch the movie again, I'm probably going to fall in love with it a little bit more. And if I watch it again after that, I'm probably going to love it a lot.
And I think that's very indicative of Cian France.
Yeah.
And so when we look at Blue Valentine, we look at Place Beyond the Pines. I always want to call it Place Between the Pines. The Place Beyond the Pines.
Right. You kept wanting to say Light Between Two Oceans.
I know.
This.
With his titles, for some reason, I want to put more words in there or different words. I like my words better than his. You see, here's the thing, though. You're right. His focus on characters and relationships to each other, always very raw, and he always comes up with an interesting way of shooting these things.
Oh, yeah.
For example, Blue Valentine, he shot that separated by several months. So he showed the couple originally in love,
mm-hmm.
then split them apart, literally, came back, I think it was 6 months or a year later, shot them again so that they actually had time apart so they could reapproach this and then not be getting along. So he's done creative things, and his attention to realism in those films I think is impeccable and really interesting, makes for some really compelling stuff. So I found it really interesting when he comes to this film, a period piece,
yep.
is he going to be able to pull off that realism for the period? I think that's questionable here. I think there are some parts where I go, that's not the 20s. No. Close. And that's not the 30s. Close. So I think there is some question as to that authenticity of the eras that we're looking at. The other thing that I also thought was interesting about it is that because it's a romance, it has that potential to go into complete sappy mode.
Yeah.
It, in my opinion, keeps itself in check just enough that people who didn't necessarily want to maybe barf at a sappy romance, they're actually, this is not going to be one of those films. This is actually, it does enough to hold itself back that it compels you with, I think, the drama going forward, yeah, that you don't ever get just inundated with, ugh, well, too much Velveeta.
And I think that's because of the inherent ugliness of the central scenario. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's be frank, they steal a child.
Yeah.
And that is distasteful. Mm-hmm. But because of that, it actually ends up making the love that develops between Vikander and Fassbinder, mm-hmm, all the stronger.
Yeah.
You believe it because they are so corrupted and distraught and torn apart by what it is they've done, and yet they understand the goodness of what it was they were trying to do.
Yeah. And now in and real life, by the way, they are an actual couple. I believe they met on this shoot. So
would not surprise me.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
there's a lot going on for this movie. I find myself wanting more from it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it delivers on everything, yeah, but I think it's still a solid piece of work.
So here's the other thing, though, that you and I were talking about last night. So the score in this is by Alexandre Desplat,
yep,
and he has sort of a minimalist patterned score in this, or it's based on repetition, very 20th century movement going, yeah, on in there. And you walked away from it and said, well, wow.
I think it's one of his best in a while.
Right.
I really liked it. I love the Philip Glass influences.
Uh-huh.
I love the my brain just stopped working. But the composer of the music from the piano.
Mm-hmm.
There's elements in here that remind Michael Nyman. There's, mm-hmm, there's elements in here that reminded me of that as well. And I think they work perfectly inside, mm-hmm, this film, inside of this world that Sion Francis created. I think those kind of themes and that repetition and that pattern, I think it stirred something in me,
yeah,
and I really responded to it. And I know you weren't, you had more issues with it.
I'm not
than
as in love with it, yeah, because,
yeah,
I know that Desplat, his way of creating a score often does put a bunch of puzzle pieces together, and it all is supposed to be interworking. And he does that here. This, mm-hmm, is sort of his known thing. The unfortunate thing to me was there were a number of points where his score actually pulled me out of the film, and I noticed it. And that to me is often a sign of, didn't quite achieve the end result, where you're looking to a good score you should never really notice unless you actually are looking for it. And in this case, there were a few times where, like I say, it just brought me out and I went, oh, okay.
See, and that was the response I had, yeah, with his last collaboration with Vikander, if you will. Even,
sure,
though, I mean, they obviously didn't collaborate, but
yeah, yeah,
the Danish Girl score, that was my problem with the Danish Girl score, is I felt like it was just too intrusive inside the film.
Hmm.
I didn't feel that here.
Yeah. So, okay. So basically breaking this down between the two of these, theater, rent, skip.
I think it's a strong rent. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the visuals, it almost becomes a theater. I mean, this movie, mm-hmm, is so beautifully shot. I, yep, I do really kind of wish people would see it in a theater. But I think for the value you get out of it, it's probably a strong rental.
Mm-hmm. I might go along with that as well at this point. I think this is one we're going to want to remember for award season when we come forward. You weren't as strong on that. Kind of saying,
I don't think it's going to be part of, especially with the box office numbers being what they were,
right,
and how Touchstone, it's their last co-collaboration that Disney is having with DreamWorks,
mm-hmm,
and the fact that they released this over Labor Day weekend and they didn't really put much marketing into it.
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, all that stuff comes into play when we're talking about Oscars. And I also think with the rapturous responses that some of the films that have now played in the Telluride Film Festival and that are playing in the Toronto Film Festival right now are getting, I just don't see how this ends up being part of the conversation, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Although, I will say, and not for this movie, per se,
mm-hmm,
but one of our stars here, Rachel Weisz, has had an incredible year.
Yeah.
And I would love it if she gets recognized for one of the three films that she's been in, including...
Yeah, Complete Unknown, which this... You and I think I both, we walked away from, you actually were at a different screening of this because you had a chance, I believe, to talk with the director,
yes,
on this.
Yes, yeah. I actually interviewed writer-director Joshua Marston about this film,
yeah,
and I actually watched it at home.
Yeah.
I had a screener, so I watched it twice at home.
Yeah, which, good call on that, because this, I think, begs seeing at least twice. So
I agree.
The gist of this is we've got this guy. He's already contemplating a move across the country for his wife, and she's got a graduate program going on, or potentially going on, in jewelry making. And so her husband, the already successful Tom, played by Michael Shannon, is kind of grilled by his family and friends on his own birthday, mind you.
I know.
This is supposed to be his day of, like, enjoyment. when this mysterious party attendee arrives, and she's ringing a bell with him. He's like, mm-hmm. this one, what is the deal? She's
the date of his best friend and coworker.
Yeah, exactly. Dating his best friend and coworker. Best friend and
guest
coworker.
Of. Sure. Not, he wants to date. She's not quite sure.
This guest, Alice, Rachel Weiss, manages to catch his attention.
Yep.
They go out to the clubs. And before they go out to the clubs, he's starting to figure this out. There's something interesting about Alice in unusual ways. Her history is retold and told and retold, and more stories come out. Exactly who is Alice to Tom is the better question. And that's kind of what lingers throughout the film. And I don't know if I want to give any more away than that. Would you?
It's hard because, I mean, if we're being honest, and this is what I talked to with Marston about, the movie's central mystery is given an answer 30 minutes in. So 30 minutes into the movie, you are given an answer as to why Tom thinks he recognizes Alice.
Mm-hmm.
So that mystery is essentially solved. But it's not really the mystery of the movie. I don't want to talk about it too much.
Yep.
Because even though they give away that answer, it's not the main answer that you need to be pondering at the very end when Alice is walking away.
It's more of a Matryoshka doll. You open it up, there's another doll. You open it up, there's another doll. You open it up, there's another doll. And it just keeps drilling down further and further.
Perfect way to describe it. Mm-hmm. This is a movie about self. I mean, it's how we compose who we are as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And, we all have these flights of fantasy about reinventing ourselves and jetting off to Australia to become... great surfers underwater basket weavers in Tanzania.
I likened it to running off and joining the circus.
Exactly. I mean, it's those dreams that you have. And this is a case of what is the cost of potentially doing something like that?
Mm-hmm.
What are you sacrificing about who you are if you do something like that?
Mm-hmm.
But what also is the allure? What is the attraction? And can you slip into it without even realizing it?
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of the dynamic and the dialogue that ends up happening between Tom and Alice throughout the remainder of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is, even though there are a bunch of people at the dinner party and the movie is moderately opened up, it's not just at the dinner party. It's like you said, they go to a dance club and they end up...
Mm-hmm.
It is a movie. It is a New York movie where New York is utilized. That said, it is essentially still just a two-person chamber piece.
Mm-hmm.
It is mostly... the Rachel Weisz, Michael Shannon show. Yes, Danny Glover and Kathy Bates show up for an important key scene.
And it's a great scene.
It's a great scene. We can't talk about it at all, but it's a fantastic scene. And they're wonderful in it. Danny Glover hasn't been this good in ages. He hasn't been asked to do something this wonderful in ages.
Right.
And
you'll never look at Goat's Hoof the same
again. No, yeah. You won't. But this is the Rachel Weisz, Michael Shannon show, and it is a two-person dialogue-driven film. It very easily could be transposed to the stage. That is not a criticism. Mm-hmm. I still think this works as a movie, as a theatrical, cinematic experience. And the dialogue that is going between these two is just fantastic. And the performances by these two are also mesmerizing.
Shannon alone, the pain that you see expressed on his face, he's just got one of those haunting faces to begin with. But it's so artful and so well portrayed that between him and Weiss, it's a powerhouse when it comes to the melodrama that they're bringing to this. And it, in my opinion, begs a second watch. You're fortunate to have had that chance to see that second watch, because I walked away from this film going, gosh, I really need to see that again just to pick up all the subtleties that the two of them have back and forth. And I'm wondering if that comes across in viewing number two.
Oh, it totally does. Shannon is extraordinary in this movie, but it's Rachel Weisz to me who is just mesmerizing, because this character of Alice easily could have become a caricature, could have easily slipped into comedy, could have easily just become some sort of melodramatic cliche. She finds a way to ground this person who really has no sense of self.
Yeah.
She is what she creates, not who she actually is.
Yeah.
And yet she finds a way to make this character relatable and authentic and real and human in a way that is just almost tragically poignant at times.
Yeah. And still seductive in the question of what if.
Exactly. Yeah. Rachel Weisz really has had a wonderful year in movies that people have just not had the time to go see. I mean, these if you look at her performance in The Lobster and you look at her performance in The Light Between Oceans, we just asked, and then you look at her performance here, just a wonderful year for this act. I mean, there's a reason she's an Oscar winner.
Yeah.
And Michael Shannon, there's a reason he's been nominated. He's fantastic.
My one beef with this is the final scripting device, which to me just seems played out, and it's a cop-out. It doesn't destroy the film, but it's sort of this, oh, really? You had to take it there sort of moment.
I think it works, though, just because you have to have an answer to the question that's posited at the beginning of the film.
Mm.
And I like that they actually don't spell it out too clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Shannon's performance in that moment really sort of sells it.
Yeah.
But the last scene of the movie with Vice.
Yep.
And I don't want to talk. I mean, but that.
Super strong.
That's the kicker. I mean, you juxtapose what she does with what he does, and that ends up having been the point to the movie. It's like when I talk to Marston, you offer a solution early on, but it's not the solution. Mm-hmm. The solution doesn't come until those two scenes are juxtaposed at the very end.
Sure thing. So Theater Rent Skip, I'm theater,
theater
on this. You're theater
on this.
I'm a high
theater. It's a wonderful movie.
Ferret this one out. Go see this one. The Complete Unknown. Just Complete Unknown.
Complete Unknown. Again, you're trying to add words.
I know. Sully. Tell me about Sully. This is Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks.
Can he do no wrong?
And he's a captain again.
Yes.
I know. Captain Hanks, once more. Into the Breach, Dear Friends.
Yes.
This is a movie that you can pretty much do the synopsis of in a single sentence.
The plane crashed in the Hudson. Everybody survived. This is his story.
Basically, yeah.
I think that works. That was a semicolon like, and then maybe a comma.
Probably, yeah. It is the story of Captain Chelsea Sully Sullenberger, who on January 15th, 2009, he had a forced water landing, as he liked to call it, of his Airbus.
I think it was A320.
A320 in the Hudson River. And the strength of this movie is that it is about that forced water landing and the aftermath as it affected both Sully and his co-pilot,
Aaron Eckhart.
Yes, Aaron Eckhart is, and he's playing Jeff Skiles.
Yeah.
It's basically about those two men and how this event affected them. That's it. That is the movie. We get, directed by Clint Eastwood.
Who, by the way, Clint Eastwood, this is a man who doesn't know how to make a film less than
2 hours.
2 hours easily.
Yeah, and this movie's 92 minutes.
And that's interesting. We'll come back to that.
Yeah, and that's a positive.
Right. So Eastwood, director, continue.
Yes. But I mean, this is a movie. What Eastwood is going to do, he's essentially created a procedural about the crash and its aftermath.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's going to do is he's going to show us the crash three different times, essentially from three different perspectives. But what he's really doing is showing us different facets of what went into making this a success, why this ended up being a heroic act, whether Sully Sullenberger wants to say it was heroism or not. He is going to show everything that went into making this a heroic act, not just on his part, not just on his co-pilot's part, not just on his crew's part, but also in the case of the city of New York, the way the citizens of New York instantly responded when this plane hit the Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part I think most people forget about, is that, yes, Sully and Skiles had the difficult thing to do here, and that was land a plane in a river.
But really, it's this bigger melodrama that goes on. You're right.
But
and Eastwood,
if the city doesn't respond within those minutes,
right,
it doesn't matter that he saved all 155 people on that plane. They would have all drowned
because
the plane was going to sink. So the
I don't know if it was going to sink. They were on little rafts.
No, but I mean, but if the city, people would have died had the city not responded within minutes.
The other thing I think that was interesting to me about this, and I don't know if this hits you the same, but I went into this kind of thinking to myself, going, all right, I know this story. The plane hits the river. Everybody gets out. Wah, wah. I can handle this. I found this surprisingly emotional, and I still don't know why. I still don't know what chord was struck in me, per se, that made me go, ooh, this is hitting me in the feels, and I can't entirely wrap my arms around this entirely. I can say that I think part of it is the group or the humanity mm-hmm. rising to the cause, and I think that is inspiring in its own right, and that could be it. I think it's also the triumph that we see Sullenberger and Skiles come to when it comes to their actual, what is it, their jury, the hearing.
They have a hearing with the
NTSB.
Yes.
And I think it's that sort of the underdog coming through. And I think that to me was also inspiring because I wonder, and I'm sure there's going to be another pilot or captain out there who has the fortitude, the experience, and the, I'll leave it at that, fortitude and experience to go against the NTSB and say, no, you're wrong, and here's why. And he actually wins.
Yeah.
I don't know many pilots or directors, or captains, mind you.
Sure.
But that is one of those things that I think if it had to happen to a guy, Sully was the guy to have that happen to.
And that's the strength of Todd Kormanecki's script, mm-hmm. is that it just focuses on these two events. It focuses on the plane in the water, mm-hmm. and it focuses on how these two pilots deal with the NTSB,
yeah.
and how they get them to realize they are not thinking like pilots when they're analyzing this crash.
When they're
analyzing this incident incorrectly. And once they start seeing it through the eyes of the people that were there,
mm-hmm. yeah.
of course this is what, you know, how it had to work out.
The other thing that I think that is interesting is Eastwood does incorporate a number of other human stories in this. It's kind
and
of like he can't pull his punches on this. He has to throw
have
in
a couple in there.
Was it necessary?
Well, I mean, and part of that obviously is Kormanecki's script.
Yeah.
And part of that is Eastwood is an old school, you know, his filmmaking chops were learned from the likes of Sergio Leone mm-hmm. and Don Siegel and, you know, all of these people that he worked with in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so he almost can't help himself from throwing in some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I get why Kormanecki writes Laura Linney. Laura Linney is Sully's wife, Lorraine, and I would guess the conversations that they have in the movie probably are pretty close to ones that they actually did have in real life.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, she's there for three phone calls.
Yep.
That's her only reason to be in the movie, is to talk to Tom Hanks on the phone three times. And the idea is that it's supposed to, you know, it gives us a little bit more insight into Tom Hanks. It makes us understand what he's going through, what Sully is feeling at these points. You know, his own paranoia and worry that he did actually do something wrong and how he is working these out in his head.
And he does have a bit of a poker face.
Yes.
So it's actually kind of important that she is there to help bring that out. Otherwise, there could be question.
Exactly. But she's also there just to add a little bit of an extra melodramatic push into the film mm-hmm. that the movie doesn't need.
Mm-hmm.
The reason the movie works is because it's this United 93. I mean, obviously, that's a completely different film, but it is in many ways this United 93-like procedural of mm-hmm. what happened, when, and why.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't need this little extra melodramatic push. It's just not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a little subplot about two 30-something guys going on a golfing trip with their dad.
Yep. Do we need it?
We don't really need it. It's there. It's a little silly. And then we have Michael Rapaport show up as a stereotypical New York barkeep halfway through the movie, just so that Sully can have an aha moment
yep.
where he realizes what he needs to talk about with the NTSB.
While enjoying his own drink,
yes.
the Sully.
And maybe something like that happened. Maybe it was based on, I mean, yeah. and I'm sure, you know, it's New York. Sully walks into a place, they're going to have reactions
Sully
like that.
Sully walks into a bar, orders a drink. What's he get? Grey Goose with a splash of water.
The problem is that it's Michael Rapaport basically being Michael Rapaport, and
yeah.
I love Michael Rapaport, but you can't help but sit there and watch the movie and go, oh, look, it's Michael Rapaport.
Yeah.
It takes you out of the film. So it's
yeah.
little things like that that I think keep the movie from being one of Eastwood's best.
Yeah.
But the movie still works really well. And what we haven't talked about again is that 92-minute thing.
And I was going to say, how about that handbrake ending, though? Because to me, the one thing that did stand out is when it hits the brakes and when movie done, click, it
perfect.
Was as if somebody hit the emergency brake and draw this thing to a complete halt.
And that's perfect. I mean, that's yeah. where it needed to be. I mean, everything is said.
Yep.
There's no reason to keep going on. Victory is attained. We did it. done.
One thing I will say, stay through the credits though, because you do get to see you do get to see everybody else though, and it is really, that also is kind of heartwarming to get to watch those credits one more time and just kind of see all the survivors.
I agree.
And does he actually see Skiles and Sully right there one more time?
I'll say this. This is a very good movie with little things that make me kind of not want to put it in that upper echelon. If this movie ends up being a box office hit, and I'm not saying it needs to do the same kind of numbers that American Sniper did. That's a different thing. Mm-hmm. No movie's going to do those kind of numbers as far as what Eastwood's concerned. But if this movie becomes a hit, if this makes, you know, $100, $150 million, watch out for it when Oscars are announced. Yeah. Because it's the kind of populist entertainment that Oscar loves.
So theater.
Theater.
Sure. All right. Totally. 70 millimeter film. This is a big celluloid chunk. When photographers and cameramen are out trying to shoot a film and they shoot on 70 millimeter, they're not messing around. This is the type of thing that takes a huge lens, a monster aperture. It's hard to keep in focus. This is an art, shooting on 70 millimeter.
Yeah, that's what Quentin Tarantino, that's one of the things when he was talking about making The Hateful Eight. I mean, that was why he did it, is because he wanted those vistas. He wanted things to look
Of Arabia.
Yeah, he needed it to look like that.
Now, Cinerama doing a 70 millimeter fest.
Which they haven't in a couple of years because, you know, for various reasons, it's hard to get these prints.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so nice that the Cinerama and, you know, program director Greg Wood were able to get this back, to bring us another 70 millimeter film festival. And, I mean, so it starts today, and we've already got sellouts. I mean, 2001 A Space Odyssey is the first film being shown at 7 p.m. tonight, and it's sold out.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, it's sold out for its next screening, that they added a third screening because the first two are sold out. They're showing Aliens in 70 millimeter two times. Both of those are sold out. Apocalypse Now is showing, and it's down to, I mean, it's only it's showing a couple times. The first showing that it has on Sunday, September 11th, is down to 70 seats.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is fantastic.
This is crazy stuff. I mean, Lawrence of Arabia is already sold out.
You had a chance to talk with the actual program director.
I did. Greg Wood.
Greg, let's take a listen to this because you had a chance to get with him on the phone real quick. We're going to drop in a couple minutes of this so you folks at home can hear the kind of the enthusiasm that Greg is bringing to this and some of the painstaking efforts it's taken to actually bring some of these prints right back to the silver screen. Take a listen.
70 millimeter went through a phase where, you know, it was really expensive to make, so it was so popular, there was a phase that people were actually shooting the movies in 35 millimeter, and then they would blow it up onto a 70 millimeter negative to show the film. So that's why they call it 70 millimeter blow-ups. So it's not filmed with a true 70 millimeter camera, but it's projected off a 70 millimeter negative.
You and I have been talking in the past, you know, for other festivals where you've been saying that this was a festival you did not want to see come to an end.
True.
That you were having trouble finding these prints.
Well, it's not really trouble finding them. It's trouble having people lend them anymore. Uh-huh. So what happened recently is, you know, with Hateful Eight being distributed in so many theaters, a lot of people rushed out to put 70 millimeter in to kind of answer that call. And the result was, you know, a lot of theaters trained properly for film, so the prints did not get handled very well. Mm-hmm. So then all of a sudden you got a lot of these people across the nation who can run 70 millimeter with equipment, but, you know, the prints were coming back in bad conditions. So a lot of the vaults and archives who have good prints just closed down to protect their libraries. So that's what's happened recently. So a lot of it is just it's hard to get access to run some stuff anymore.
You couldn't ask for a better year to be showing Aliens in 70 millimeter, right?
Yeah, true. I mean, that was definitely, you know, fortunate that, you know, we got in touch with the University of North Carolina School of Arts, which was a hard one to find, and then they just, you know, we had a great relationship, so they let us roll with that, and Apocalypse Now, those are some of the key ones we've never run before, which are going to be really fun. And then Fox, for example, has, you know, the master library. They have the most titles out of all 70, and they're not lending it all anymore. But we did convince them for this festival, which was a major, major coup. I mean, usually, like, we know we can do 2001 because we made that print in Lawrence of Arabia. So we know the biggest two movies are available to us. So at that point in time, it just becomes, okay, what can we put around it? And then we started sinking our teeth into a couple other major titles. I mean, it's always hard to not see things like, you know, Vertigo's not in it, and Mad Mad World, and some of those prints, you know, were just not available to us.
I think what's fun about this festival, though, is that it's because we have, you know, filmmakers like Nolan and Tarantino, who's so huge on shooting in 70mm, on making sure 70mm prints were available. We get this mixture of stuff that's brand new.
Yeah, we never ran Interstellar, and I think also to have, like, the artsy content like Baraka, which is really, you know, true to 70mm, I mean, it's pretty amazing to cover the spectrum that we are. I mean, this is my favorite festival that we've put together because of that.
And there you go. So, Greg Wood, 70mm Cinerama Film Festival. Sarah, what's the website on that?
Cinerama.com.
And we can get all the information, tickets, and so forth to go from there. That's perfect.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and... get your tickets now, because they're selling out for everything. I have tickets for a lot of them.
Yeah.
My guest canceled, so if anybody out there wants to be my guest, you know, just hit me up.
Sarah@moviefreak.com.
You got it.
There you go. So, hey, this is Cinema Squabble, episode number 42. Sarah, we've seen Sully. We both give that strong theater recommendations. The Light Between Light Between Oceans. There I go again.
You did it again.
Two rental recommendations, Complete Unknown, two theater recommendations, and Morgan splitting us up a little bit, one skip, one rental. Mm. You working on any projects right now?
I got that Joshua Marston interview, which is up on the website, also on Seattle Gay News.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, no real big projects right now. I will say I want to give a little shout out to the Northwest Film Forum.
Mm-hmm.
They've got the local premiere of my favorite film and Adam's hated film. Mm-hmm. Chatty Caddies is happening tonight. If you can't go to the Cinerama, go watch some Chatty Caddies.
Or not. Okay. So, Cinema Squabble, episode 42. Thank you much for joining us. Give us the stars, the thumbs up, the likes if you can do it. We would greatly appreciate it. Thank you, Sarah Michelle Fetters, Adam Gerke, and Sprints Arbogast, our producer.